over here.
On the light, yeah.
I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah, now you...
Yeah, okay, we're on side two now.
Yeah, we're okay.
Okay.
So anyway, Sylvia, this is craziness. Besides, it's going okay now.
Yeah.
She said, what's going to happen to all the Spaniards? If we go to war, you're not going to go anywhere. So she said, this is nonsense. But she was 8.5 months pregnant.
Oh, dear.
So I said, uh-oh, this is fourth child. I delivered the third child, Gary, in the parking lot, well, in the hallway of the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia. Christopher John in El Paso, she delivered herself because the doctor had gone down the hallway to get a cup of coffee, and she just delivered. She had very fast labors. So I said, well, we're not going to get to that hospital. They may have the roads blocked. Who knows what? So I brought home a Percip pack. The nurses gave me a Percip pack with all the necessary stuff. So a few days later, and I think the Cuban Missile Crisis is still on, she nudges me in the middle of the night and says, the baby's coming. We're going to have a baby very soon. So I get up, turn on the light. Yes, the baby's crowning. I open up the Percip pack, and I deliver Marty in bed. He's our fourth son. This would be November of 62. But with the commotion, Peter and Chris heard it, and they came to the door and was watching their little brother Marty being born. And the chica, Rosario, who lived with us, they all were live-in maids, she came to the door, and she didn't speak very good English, but she was saying, you know, mama mia, por Dios, you know, the usual typical stuff. And I instinctively, this is the truth, I instinctively turned to her and said, go boil some water.
I
saw too many movies. And got her out of the way, and then Celia said to her in Spanish, go up the street and get Dr. Allen, Van Allen, who's the physician who now practices in Modesto. He was another neighbor up the street. So she ran up and got the neighbor. Marty was already born. I had the cord clamped and cut, but I had trouble. I couldn't get the placenta delivered. So, and Van tried, but we said, well, we're not obstetricians. So we got her in the car, took her out to the base, and took Marty with us. He was an infant. Fortunately, in those days, we had maids, so she stayed with the other three, Peter, Chris, and Gary.
Goodness, these were all uncomplicated deliveries,
yeah,
although you
they were.
Could have handled them.
They would.
Sure.
So we, and Marty was
but
fine.
But at home.
So we went out, and she went and spent the day there, or the evening, and the next day.
The baby was full term.
Yes. Well, Marty was filled to full term. And then the obstetrician came in, and subsequently was able to deliver the placenta, and she had no more complications. So... That was another experience, is delivering Marty at home in the middle of this Cuban Missile Crisis when they're saying, you know, we may have to evacuate at any moment. I mean, and Celia said, well, this is crazy. We're not going anywhere. We stayed right here.
Oh, yeah.
So, and those are some of the, I can't remember too many other things.
Were,
that
you were there when Kennedy died.
Oh, yes. That was the next year.
Did you see... the way the local, the Spaniards
yes, it was
took
amazing.
It.
It was absolutely
that
amazing.
That had to be
it was amazing.
An eye-opener for you.
Well, first of all, that afternoon and that evening and the next day, many of Celia's relatives and other friends drove out to Royal Oaks, came to our house to offer their condolences.
Oh, my.
Secondly, they had memorial masses in the cathedral downtown. Thirdly, the embassy opened up its doors with a book. The line at the Madrid embassy, which was not unlike what happened in England and other places, went on for 3 days and three nights. Something close to 1 million madrileños came to the embassy and signed that book. I don't know where any of those books are. They're probably in the State Department. And that happened all over Europe. I mean, he was so...
I've heard that.
Oh, yes,
you
absolutely.
Saw it. You actually saw it.
Saw it. They came to my home.
Mm.
We got cards from all of Celia's relatives. They were offering condolences to us as though it was our brother or our sister. It was amazing. And the most amazing thing was the churches rang bells in Madrid. The people came to the embassy. I mean, he was a beloved man as far as many Europeans were at the time. And that was the way they showed their... not unlike what was going on in the United States. I mean, it was a horrendous thing here. And we knew nothing about it other than the seeing the satellite pictures every few hours. But when we came home the next year, Celia's dad and mom, then they had kept Life magazine and New York Times and all that, told us about what that event was like in New York. I mean, people were glued to their television for the hours.
I remember, I was here.
Well, Madrid, the Spaniards, the outpouring of emotion and devotion and grief and express, and many Americans who lived on the economy, because all the Americans lived on the base, many who lived on the economy gave the same stories, how their neighbors and friends or total strangers, if they knew you were an American, would offer their condolences as though this was your father or your brother that died. It was a very interesting experience.
It was a time of growing up.
Yeah.
For so many people, you know.
Well, we hadn't had an assassination since Lincoln, 100 years earlier.
We just read about it in history books.
Mm-hmm. At any rate, that was another important part of Madrid. Then, other things. Well, my sister came and met her husband, and.
What we can do is we will be filling in things. Because when you read the transcripts of this part of Spain,
I'm sure it'll bring back other
experience.
Things.
It may bring in, and we'll go on. We'll go back to it.
Okay.
So, if you'd like, we can talk now about going to San Antonio and how that came.
All righty. Well, I told you I was in Washington in December. I had 6 months more on my tour of duty in Spain. I went to see the sergeant.
Why did you have only? Were you in Spain for only a set period? You
3 years.
Finish your other 2 years there if you want.
I could have, and I went and talked to one of the colonels. He said, "Well, we have extended people for 1 year, but it's not likely you would get permission to stay for 5." I knew I had 2 more years.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured if I had 2 years, and he advised me actually, he said, if you have 2 years, you're likely to get a good assignment. If you stay here for 4 and have only 1 more year to go, they'll use you as cannon fodder and fill in any old place, and who knows where you'll
Tricky.
Go. Right.
Yeah.
So I said, but also Celia and I were beginning to see something that we've often talked about, our children being raised more and more by the maids.
Oh.
And concerning ourselves, because we had given thought, as many physicians, many Americans had, sort of the fantasy of living there, becoming an expatriate, getting out of the service and living there and practicing medicine, because there was certainly a need for good doctors there,
yeah.
And living high on the hog. Well, that was nonsense and naive.
Yeah.
But we had the feeling that we wanted to get back home before our kids were ready to start school. We wanted them at that time to go to a Catholic school, which they started. The base school was perfectly okay. But also that we might be losing touch with our own kids. So there was that. There was a variety of those things, but I think that the overriding thing is if they had said, you can spend another year here, and then we'll give you whatever you want your fifth year, but they didn't say that. As a matter of fact, as I'll say later, one of the reasons I got out of the military is they moved people around. If they had said to me later, you can stay in San Antonio for 10 years and teach, you like I could in the medical school, you can make a career here, and we're not going to move you all over the place. But when I subsequently talked to Murph Chesney before he became Surgeon General and several others, I talked about that, and they said, well, why are you getting out of the service? You have 11 years. You're now finishing up the 2 years in San Antonio. You're a major. I was promoted. You have a wonderful career ahead of you. You might someday, go up the line and become an important officer. And I said, well, the problem is I'm first treated as an officer, not a physician. And I said to a couple of them, I don't think I said this to Murph, I said to others, I'm an officer because I'm a physician. I'm not a physician because I'm an officer. You don't make me a physician. And because I'm an officer first in your mind, you're going to move me around whatever the Air Force needs are. And that's understandable. And that's what a career officer has to understand. I'm sure Eisenhower didn't like going all over the world, when he was a young guy. and a lot of other career officers, you know, bounced around, and their wives bounced around every 2 years.
It's not always a case of need. It's just a case of that's the Army routine.
Or the Air Force routine. They move you, and we don't want you to get stale or stagnant, and so they move you. And I said, well, if you told me I could have even two assignments in the next 10 years, 5 years here, 5 years someplace else, both of them are teaching hospitals, because I had made the decision, I'll be involved with residents and interns and all that, then I would probably, I might have stayed. But no, there was nothing like that. It was said with sorry, you had your 3 years here, you go to San Antonio for two, we don't know what will happen to you after that. And some sergeant in Washington will reassign you, you know, when the time comes. Because they have, anyway.
You were lucky to have the 3 years, actually.
Right, exactly. And at any rate, we came back, you know that story. We bought a whole.
Well, no, I don't know. Do I know the story of why you decided on? Oh, the sergeant then
I asked to go to a teaching hospital.
To a teaching.
And at that time, they only had several. They had opened up the one.
So this was a new. This was a new hospital in
Lackland Air Force Base. Yeah, it was called Wilford Hall. Wilford Hall Air. Well, it's called the Wilford Hall Hospital, named for somebody, at Lackland Air Force Base. And they had opened their teaching programs there a few years earlier, in the early 60s. This is now 64. And they had a residency in pediatrics with interns, and they had residents in medicine and surgery and all the rest. It was going to become one of their big, it is now, still to this day, it's a big teaching hospital. It's part of the University of Texas now in San Antonio. So I said, fine, if I could go there, I'd love it. So I got assigned there, and I told you that story already. So, and I also told you that the chairman of the department didn't know he was going to get an extra doctor.
Right.
So I show up, and...
and this was what year?
I'm there now in July of 1964. So Celia and I arrive back with four little kids, and she's pregnant now with Leslie. So we have four little boys. Peter's coming up on seven. And Leslie's about to be born. It's a 7-year difference. So we have four little kids. We rent a house out near a Catholic school, near the freeway, so I could drive to work each day. It was about a 20-minute, half-hour drive to the base. We did not live on base. Not too many people did there. I got assigned. I went in and signed in, and they assigned me to the pediatric clinic. And so then I ran the pediatric clinic there for 2 years. And we had in pediatrics, we had a couple of cardiologists, and we had a guy in infectious disease, and we had a guy in endocrinology, and we had a guy in kidney, and we had two or three people running the nursery. So it was a very sophisticated, by then, fairly sophisticated department of pediatrics, maybe 10 or 12 full-time pediatricians.
There again,
all full-time. For
dependents.
All for the Air Force and their dependents, but also a referral hospital for much of central United States. So when they'd have sick kids in little small Air Force bases in Texas and Oklahoma and wherever, they'd fly them in, because that was the referral.
But military people.
That would be the referral hospital for most of the central United States. If you're on the West Coast, you go to Travis,
right,
which is just opening up. And if you're on the East Coast, they send you to Andrews or Walter Reed or someplace. So anyway, it was fairly sophisticated. And most of these other fellows had fellowships by now. Fellowship training was just becoming popular. I never had fellowship training. Probably in today's world I would. All three of my sons have had fellowship training in today's world. But in those days, it was just getting started. So the cardiologists and the rheumatologists and the infectious disease guy and the people running the nursery, they all had... not only the 2 years of pediatric residency like I had, they all had a couple of years of fellowship and were subspecialized. So I was the least well-trained of them all. So I was assigned to the clinic, which was fine. I would have a couple of residents there and a couple of interns. And occasionally we'd get medical students from the University of Texas, but I don't remember much of that at all. And they'd come, so I ran the clinic. I saw patients walk in and by appointment. Whatever they had, I supervised the residents. So there was my first taste now of being a couple of years out of training, having had a fairly good medical experience in Spain, feeling fairly confident, but also knowing upstairs in the pediatric department, there were six or seven or colleagues who were better off, you know, smarter than I and better trained. I could always call them. So we had specialty clinics and cardiology and that sort of thing. So, but I always had some residents and interns, and my job was to see some of my own patients. I would develop a cadre of private patients. And I took care of a lot of the other doctors' kids, a lot of the other doctors in the hospital. Their wives would come, and I would be their private pediatrician in that sense, private, small p, and I got to be friendly with some of them. And
all the doctors were military?
All of them. All of them were Air Force, absolutely. Because over the other side of town was Brooke Army Hospital, which was an Army hospital, had the same programs, but for Army doctors and for Army personnel and their dependents. So they now mix them together, but in those, which makes sense. As a taxpayer, I can understand that. But in those days, the Air Force was on one side of San Antonio, the Army was on the other side of San Antonio, and you went to one of those hospitals, and you seldom, except in a true emergency, ever were taken care of.
They were very proprietary.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Craziness. Mm-hmm. Craziness. Now, of course, and the same thing in Washington. Can you imagine having Walter Reed and Bethesda in an Air Force hospital? That's crazy. Now,
Navy,
there's a
Navy hospital.
Yeah, lots more cooperation, but then in those days there wasn't, although they'd occasionally have meetings together. At any rate, that was my job for those 2 years, and it began clearly to dawn on me that the Air Force was not my career. I had talked to a few people. I said, if I extend and stay in a few more years, do I have any guarantees? Well, no, because they may need to send you to some other place, you know. And it was so vague. And I said, well,
what a shame that the mentality was such, because they would have kept
well,
an outstanding educator.
In fact, well, they didn't know
they
that
could.
At the time.
Well, you were starting teaching, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, but I was hardly outstanding. All the other people were.
Well, that's what you
the other people were. The other people were. The other people were.
But look at the people they lose, because
they did lose a lot.
The mentality is
yeah.
so rigid.
They did. They lost, I can name several who went on and became professors of pediatrics elsewhere. I, one of the neonatologists went to Wisconsin. One of the endocrinologists went to Chicago. The cardiologist got out and went to Memphis. Now, they did keep a couple, and there were several who just stayed on, and one of the cardiologists, I think, spent his entire career at Lackland and never moved him. That's not true. He went to Germany for a couple of years. But so I can't say it was universal. But certainly, when you'd talk to the colonels and the big shots, it was all, well, you know.
No guarantee.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the Vietnam War is on. This is now 1964. And Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy's dead. Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson is getting on the TV every day talking about the war.
Sure.
So there was even less likelihood that they were going to make any commitments to anybody except you may go to Vietnam, although as a pediatrician that was unlikely. But all those other physicians could have been picked up and with 24 hours notice go to Vietnam, just as military. So there was no, so it was also at the time where there was no particular looking at trying to encourage career officers to stay with any kind of perks. Interestingly, though, about 15 years later, come 1980, they went out and recruited all over the country former Air Force and Army, particularly Air Force officers, because they were losing them and trying to bring them back in, and they would sign bonus contracts. I knew several guys, one here in Reno. As a matter of fact, Angus Marshall, who just died, remember Angus Marshall?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. ENT man, he just died, you know.
Yes, I saw that.
He went back into the Air Force.
Oh.
He practiced here for 7 or 8 years and went back in the Air Force, rose to be a colonel. I don't know the particulars of his situation.
It would be tempting, wouldn't it?
They gave bonuses, and they
sure.
said, "If you come and sign us up for 3 or 4 or 5 years,
yeah.
we'll assign you. We'll tell you in advance where you'll be sent, so that your family can move and the kids in high school, okay? And here's a bonus,
it's
and
really
you
a self-serving thing,
and we'll of course, and we'll make you a colonel." Now, I remember getting phone calls. I said, "Sorry, you know, I'm now the dean of our school here. I didn't want to do any of that." But be that as it may. In the era of 64, 5, and 6, when I was in San Antonio, And when I was making the decision to get out or to stay, Vietnam was on. So in all fairness to the people making decisions, they couldn't know the future. Hell, the anti-war things were going on.
I'm surprised that you were permitted to leave when your time was up, when you think about it, because we're in war. Was this not a...
Well, it wasn't a declared war.
So you could...
No, I think...
You could be mustered out.
Well, and the Tet Offensive and all that stuff was a little bit later, but by the time I was getting out... Besides, a pediatrician is not essential to any war effort. Now, I guess if I had been a surgeon, maybe they wouldn't have let me... I don't know. But anyway, finally, I spent a lot of time talking to the chief of pediatrics, who he and I have kept in touch for the last 30 years. He's a wonderful person. He got out. He spent his 30 years in, retired, and does some practice still to this day. He's probably 10 years older than I am. If I'm 65, he might be 72 or 3 or 4. So ultimately, I said, okay, I'm out. And Celia said, no, I think it's time to get out. We don't want to pick up. We want to settle down. Well, it turns out we didn't settle down for a couple more years, as you'll soon know. But at least we broke all of our ties. I paid back my time. I got an honorable discharge. I was discharged as a major in June of 1966. And I'd been in the service about 10 and a half years. And it was a good time. I have no regrets. And my experiences in San Antonio were very good. I mean, I learned a lot of medicine there because I was seeing, again, referral patients coming in from all over the middle part of the United States. And the staff there was excellent, and I was learning from all of them. I learned from the guy in infectious disease and the guy in cardiology. They were teaching me a lot. But I was also learning how to be a good teacher. I was learning, and they recognized me, the students and the, I shouldn't say students, there were no students, the residents and the interns recognized that I was a good teacher.
And you were finding a niche for yourself that you
enjoyed. Yes, and yes. Mm-hmm. So I then, the last 6 months, Celia and I decided, we started calling our friends, and there was a guy in New Jersey who worked at the New Jersey College of Medicine, said, come here, we'd like you to come here. And I looked at a couple of jobs in academic medicine. I looked at a job in Philadelphia, and I looked at a job in St. Louis. Actually met and got interviewed to get out of the Air Force and go and join the faculty of a couple of medical schools. But we just didn't want to go back east. So we started then, we started talking again with Ted Jacobs, who had already settled in Las Vegas. And the other eight physicians I mentioned, the surgeons, the internists, the radiologist, the orthopedist, those seven or eight people, they had all preceded me and gone to Las Vegas. Initially, their hope was to start a multi-specialty clinic that never got off the ground. But when Celia and I were not sure what we wanted to do, except we wanted to stay out west, we had no reason to go back east except for family, but that was not sufficient reason. Ted put us in touch with a pediatrician who had been in Vegas a couple of years, Tony Carter, and he needed a partner, and Vegas was beginning to boom. Remember, Vegas was, in 1966, was maybe 300,000 people. It was beginning to grow, and there was a need for doctors. So Celia and I flew out there. We got a neighbor and one of the Spanish maids, the Mexican maids, because we had even in San Antonio, we now had five children. Leslie was born there, and so we got a couple of a Mexican maid who would come over a couple of days a week and spend the day and help Celia. She needed help trying to raise five kids, so we got on the plane. We went out and spent a couple of days in. We stopped in Albuquerque to see the one doctor there. We stopped in Vegas.
You never thought of staying right there in San Antonio? We could have,
but San Antonio was a fairly sophisticated medical community and wasn't much awareness. I didn't have much awareness that there was a need for pediatricians there. Mm. But Vegas really did. I mean, I think I was the first or maybe the second or third board-certified pediatrician in in Las Vegas. There was Tony Carter and myself, and then there were three other pediatricians. But most of the child care in Vegas was...
Remember who they were by
name? Sure. Most of the child care in Las Vegas was done by family physicians. Tony Carter and I were one group, mm-hmm. and the other was Ryan Seiches. I don't know how to spell his name, but I can look it up. Dick Baker. Dick Baker's still there. Mm. He's semi-retired, and Dick Baker served on the board of medical exam with me 20 years later. So did Tony Carter served on the board for a few years. And then Ted Kapp, who interestingly, talk about coincidence, had been my chairman of pediatrics in El Paso in 1958 and wrote one of my letters of recommendation to Pennsylvania. When he got out of the Army a few years later, he went to Las Vegas, and when I arrived in Las Vegas in 1966, which is now 8 years later and 7 years later, he's in private practice there. He subsequently retired.
But you were enticed there by Ted Jacobs,
and
more or less.
Ted and Parvin. We went out there, and they put on a big shindig, had a wonderful meal in a nice fancy restaurant, and invited all the other members of the Spanish Mafia, and all of them were encouraging us to come. And all we heard from them is, look, this is a wide-open city for doctors. I mean, it's growing, and just come. And Tony and I got along fine, so we said, Celia and I went home. Well, we actually went on to Modesto and visited with our friend there, but we didn't want to practice there. And so we made the decision we were going to go to Las Vegas and enter private practice. It turned out to be a 1 year diversion, and yet in the long run, given the rest of my career, it turned out to be one of the most important 1 years we spent. Number one, I learned what private practice was like and why I didn't want to do it, but I also understood what the private practitioner was going through to some degree. Also, coming out later and helping start the medical school, all of my friends down there helped us, and I immediately had entree to that community. So when George Smith wanted me to get started getting people in Las Vegas mm-hmm. to support, I went down there frequently, and we sent students there. The very first year the school opened, we sent students there as preceptors. So, and then subsequently, because I knew people, some of the legislators were my patients at that time. I had cared for the children of a number of people in legislature and government, and had a nice private practice for the year I was there. So all of those ultimately became important connections.
So important politically, yeah.
Never thought of it at the time. Because mm-hmm. there was no discussion in 1966 about a medical school. That started in 67.
What was it that you didn't like about private practice?
I think
charging patients.
Yes,
you had never done that before.
I think you're right on. You're very perceptive. I think part of it was you now had to charge patients, and you had to charge them some money in order to pay the rent and your nurse, mm-hmm. and to take home a decent salary and pay your malpractice. And I was very uncomfortable with that. And I knew, looking at the books, that you bought immunizations for 25 cents a shot and gave them for $3, and somehow the business part of medicine was the most difficult for me. Mm-hmm. I practiced good medicine. I took care of a number of Akili Smith brought her child to see me. Remember Akili Smith? He used to be married
Prima.
To Louis Prima.
Sure.
And one night I took care of Julie London's child when she got sick, a little kid got sick. Forgotten what the details were, and I wouldn't say them publicly anyway. It'd be violating their privacy. But saw a lot of the young children of single mothers, many of them who danced topless, you know, in the shows mm-hmm. on downtown. And what I always remember, and told many people the story, is many times they didn't want a bill, and they didn't want a record, and they didn't want checks. And you'd see their child, you know, and they'd reach someplace in their underwear and bring out a wad of dollars, you know, pay you 20 or 30 bucks or whatever it was.
This must have been a shock to your
Well, it was.
Social conscience, all
it
of
was
this.
Because it was
what
the,
a switch from.
Well, it was. It was totally different, and yeah. It was the first place I ever heard about women having silicone injected into their breasts or their legs. Of course, in those days, it wasn't implants. They would actually take liquid silicone, warm it up, and inject it in a big needle. And of course, what would happen is it would migrate all over the body. It didn't stay.
Oh my word.
And I remember one of the surgeons who I mentioned earlier got so furious because dancers would come to his office and the silicone would be all down around their ankles and it had been injected in the thighs or excuse me in the calves to give them nice rounded legs, but if they warmed up and danced for a couple of hours, by the end of the evening the silicone had worked its way terrible down to their ankles and they'd wanted him to get it out.
Wouldn't this be dangerous to their immune system?
Of course. Oh, of course it was. He said, go back to the person and put it. And as a matter of fact, one of the guys, I don't remember his name, and I wouldn't mention if I did, ultimately lost his license, Ken McLean, I think. I wasn't on the board at the time. This would be in the mid-60s. Ken and others in the board took away his license, and they ran him out of town. I mean, he was a thief, and, you know, he would set up the clinic and inject showgirls with silicone. Of course, eventually it was outlawed, and then it came back years later as encased in some sort of a package for breast implants. But I mean, these were things I'd never even heard of. And a lot of cash and carry. I could look it up, but it was around 300,000.
It was that much?
Yeah, maybe 250,000, 300,000 in 1966. That's a figure you could easily look up. Maybe 250 to 300, I'm not sure. That would be maybe Clark County, all of Clark County, which was Boulder and Henderson.
Well, then you really got, you were right in the thick of it in Las Vegas. You were no longer isolated by a military installation.
Oh, gosh, no.
You were in the city practicing.
And I then was confronted.
What about welfare?
That's what I was going to say. I was then confronted with, what do we do about those who can't pay? Tony was a very good person. He is still a good person. He's still there. Matter of fact, he works in one of the big HMOs. But what we did is, and this is how I met Otto Ravenholt, who has been the health officer there for 30 some years.
Right.
What we did is we would go over to the hospital clinic or Board of Health, well, it was the health department's clinic, and see indigent patients there.
What hospital would that be?
At that time, it was Southern Nevada Memorial Hospital. Mm-hmm. It's now the University Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so we and others did do a lot of free service. And of course, once those kids were in the hospital, there was only the other people I mentioned, almost all of the other four or five pediatricians in town went to Sunrise. They didn't
do. That was the private hospital.
Yes,
wasn't it?
It is, still is. They didn't do very much work. So really, Tony and I were the only pediatricians and a bunch of family physicians, who took care of patients at Southern Nevada. It was the old county hospital. And if you were on the staff, you had to take care of indigents. Well, for a while, it was just Tony and me. So, and we were on every other night. I worked harder there in private practice than I ever did.
So there was an emergency room service.
Oh, yes.
That then.
But not full-time people. There was no residencies at the time.
So you just took your turn.
Right, you took your turn. And they'd call you, and there was this kid in the emergency room having a convulsion or something, and you were called. It was your night on. You went over there.
It was your rotation, even though you were in private practice.
You're in private practice, but in order to maintain your staff privileges at the hospital, you had you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And they had started an obstetrical residency with St. Mary's in San Francisco, so I think they had a few obstetric residents in 66, 67. But other than that, there were no residents, no students, there was no teaching. I'm not even sure there was grand rounds, because I think Ted Jacobs and Harry Knudsen, the radiologist, started having rounds and began to get some little education programs going.
But there was a Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals.
No one paid attention to it. Nobody paid attention to it. I mean, sure, they had...
I mean, you had to have certain... You had
they
to
had to have
certain
a death conference,
yeah.
And you had to have a tumor board,
mm-hmm.
And so you discussed
you
death.
You have all the medical records committees,
yeah, right,
the
right.
Credentials committees.
But I'm talking about medical education. I'm talking about grand rounds where you talked
mm-hmm.
about patients and patient care.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, all the formalities were there,
but if you had a Department of Surgery meeting, for instance,
yes.
And you were required to have one once a month,
sure.
As I recall,
yeah.
Through JCAH,
right.
They had to be educational as well as other business that was conducted. You talk about certain cases in surgery.
Mostly deaths.
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah.
There was the same thing with internal medicine. There
right.
was an OB.
But heck, in pediatrics, there were just a couple of us. And so,
we
would meet.
Yeah.
And there were some family physicians who took care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they got into trouble or had a problem, they'd call me or Tony. We took care of the sick ones. And we took care of the sick ones in the nursery. There were no neonatologists then. Remember, neonatology was just getting started in this country. Remember, we're talking about 1966. A lot of the
sure.
subspecialties were not even started.
Yeah.
So general pediatricians took care of the sick ones in the nursery. Now they don't even let you in a nursery if you're not fully trained in neonatology. And of course, in the hospital now, a lot of the really sick kids are taken care of by intensivists. We didn't know what that was 35 years ago. So, you know, Tony and I took care of whatever came along. And we did take care of the indigents, although in the daytime when we went to our offices, we saw our private patients there, and we'd see the indigents in a county clinic, and that's when I made friends with Autumn Ravenhill. So 9 months go by, and Tony has a personal crisis, which is really no business of this record, but he and I decided to part, but not over professional reasons,
mm-hmm.
personal and economic reasons. And so I called Otto Ravenholt, and I remember it because it's this week. Celia always remembers it. It was what she always remembers is our Holy Week. It was Good Friday. And he said, because I was an employee, he said, well, I really can't continue you next Monday morning. So I called Otto on the phone. And Otto says, fine, come on over Monday morning. The health department, I need some help. I'll hire you as an assistant health officer and a deputy coroner. So for I go over... I get out of private pediatric practice, and Tony and I left amicably, and we've been friends ever since. But he just wasn't the kind of fellow at the time that wanted me as a partner, or anybody as a partner, I guess. Started out all right. So I went over to see Otto, and he gave me this job. So Monday morning, 2 days after Tony says I don't have a job, and Celia and I are wondering on, we felt like, you know, Holy Thursday and Good Friday, it was my passion and crucifixion. What are we going to do? I've got 5 kids to feed, and I have no salary coming in. And I could have gone into private practice. I could have opened an office. And several people encouraged me, said, open an office and you'll do fine. People will send you patients. But I knew down in my heart of hearts that
I didn't
want to continue in private practice. Patient care is fine, teaching, and there was no teaching. There was literally no teaching, notwithstanding JCH, but there was no teaching, and nobody to teach. So I went over, and for the next couple of months, I learned a lot about the state. There was an episode at a state-sanctioned or state-run boys camp of two pedophiles, and this is public, so I'm not talking out of school, allegedly molesting boys, many of whom were orphan kids and that sort of thing. So Paul Laxalt, who's the governor at the time, he had just been elected, called Otto on the phone and said, would you and Dr. Scully go and investigate this and give me a report? He also asked Otto and I to come up to Reno and to do an inspection of the state hospital. The conditions that the mentally retarded were in, he thought were appalling, and that old Contone was terrible. Mike O'Callaghan followed through with that later. And so we wrote a report for that. I then went to the Caliente Girls School with Otto, and we did a report on the medical care there. And
so who's paying you all this time?
Otto is now. I'm now a county employee.
I see.
I'm now the assistant health officer.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting a county salary.
Getting a county salary, which was...
Couldn't have been all that.
Nah, it was about what I was making in private practice, maybe less. So I started writing up these reports on the health care of some of the state institutions, which were not terribly... Otto actually wrote the reports, or he put his name on them, but I did a lot of the work, and we report. And I remember the first time I'd ever been to governor's office, walked in, sat down with Governor Laxalt, and gave him our report. He said, well, we're going to start doing something about that in the next legislature.
I thought he was a great governor.
He was, and I think Mike was a good governor, too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So we did that, and... so we got onto those, and of course, as far as I know at the time, the pedophilic thing was taken care of. That was another thing, because I subsequently became very involved in child abuse, as you know, here in Reno. And that was the first time I really remember much about, or remember hearing much about child sexual abuse. That wasn't something we talked about in medical school. It wasn't something we talked about publicly.
I don't think people ever even thought it existed, really.
Maybe it might have existed.
You had to think about it. But.
Either in the Bible or maybe it existed in some literature someplace, but no, it was not something that was in people's consciousness. So to talk to these young kids and to listen to their stories, I got a little education, which I've always been grateful for, from Otto Ravenholt, who was a marvelous health officer, gave me a great education in... the coroner, of course, has to go out. So I can remember being called in the middle of the night. We didn't have beepers in those days. Whereas the deputy coroner, Otto was home in bed, he said, would you go and... And I'd go to hotels and motels around the town where they'd find a body, you know, and... died of a heart attack, or maybe there was some foul play, and there had to be somebody who came and looked at the scene and kept a report, and then the police would, the autopsy would be done and all that sort of stuff. So that's what a coroner does, especially if it's an unattended death, and there were a fair number of those that I remember going to where people would, either overdose or die or how they died, I don't know, in motels and hotels in Las Vegas. A lot of, there were still thousands of tourists in those days. So I did a little of that. I also remember having to go with him and the public health nurses and do inspections of a food outbreak at a food line in one of the hotels where there had been an outbreak of food poisoning. And we had to do...
Probably a Friday night when they used to have the seafood buffets.
Oh, God. And who knows whether they... and they'd poor Otto, he'd give health cards and try to... get all these people, many of them couldn't speak English, had to wash their hands. And here I'm in there with the public health nurses doing rectal swabs on all of these kitchen employees and waiters and waitresses trying to figure out who's got contamination. You didn't wash his hands and who had the salmonella. And so lo and behold, I get a phone call from my friend in New Jersey who 2 years earlier had tried to get me to come back to the New Jersey College of Medicine to run this pediatric program. And it was pure serendipitous. I don't know why he called me, except they needed someone to run their pediatric program at St. Michael's Hospital, which is an affiliated hospital to the New Jersey College of Medicine in Newark. So I knew public health wasn't my field. I had talked to Otto about maybe going to Berkeley and getting an MPH, but I knew I belonged in medical education. So I flew back. This is now about May or early June. Otto said, sure, do whatever you want. I'll keep you on here as long as you want. I can make the job permanent because you can do all sorts of things for me. You can run my pediatric clinics. You can help my public health nurses and all that. And it was there that I really gained an appreciation of public health, as nurses particularly, as a specialty. And what a wonderful job they did. I went to homes in the poor parts of Sac. I went to the Indian Colony, which was really poor in Las Vegas at the time, with the public health nurses, and walked into rooms where people were quite ill and were getting no medical care. And right down the street at the Strip, all this glitter and gulch. But be that as it may, Jim Hogan back in New Jersey encouraged me. So I flew back,
I met the administrator and the chief of pediatrics and the staff, and I said, fine, I'll take the job. So they offered me a job.
Now we're up to, you were only in Las Vegas then?
1 year.
1 year.
June of 1967.
So you were with Otto Radon Hall for about 3 months.
And I was with Tony Carter about nine months.
Well,
but it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I learned a lot.
So before we get to New Jersey.
It's 1967.
67.
Right.
I'd like to hear a little more about the private practice you had, your impressions of Las Vegas, and any other thoughts that you have and
about that.
Recollections of coroner duties.
Well, the coroner duties were interesting, and certainly I'd never been to a hotel and to inspect a dead body and tell the police that they could remove the down to the autopsy room. I did that.
You didn't have to do any of the you would just assign that this had to be done.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Yeah.
And most of the time you had to do an autopsy. Unless the wife was standing there and said, my husband, you know, we keep her here on vacation and he just had a coronary bypass or whatever.
So many of those.
Here on vacation. Yeah. And I get on the phone and talk to his doctor and said, oh, yeah, you know, we thought he might die. And we said, don't go to Las Vegas. And he did. So
stay up all night.
Yeah,
gamble,
sure.
Drink.
And, you know, when George Smith came to Reno originally, one of his first papers that he wrote about was pulmonary embolus in overweight women and men, but mostly women, who would be sitting on those high stools at the slot machines, and they'd throw a big embolus from their leg and have a pulmonary embolus and keel over dead.
Yes,
and he wrote a paper, I don't know, five or six or seven of those that he autopsied when he used to work for Sal over at the Washington Medical Center. But anyway, so yeah, most of the time I would, it would be pro forma, but a lot of times it was simply, well, we'll do the autopsy and fill out the report, particularly if it's someone who had nobody in attendance and they were alone, and there were a lot.